change is gonna come.
See that you actually are a leader.
I was with Nike for a very long time and built my career in retail.
You know, I think this podcast just got its first exclusive.
Being an entrepreneur is hard. The highs are really high and then the lows are really low.
That I'm actually really interested in hearing more about.
Can you talk to us a little bit about what it's like transitioning verticals?
Being open to opportunity.
I feel like, okay, like if not now, then when?
So hi, everybody. My name is Dahlia Strom, and I teach marketing at the Fashion Institute of Technology, as well as run a company called Rethink Connect, where we focus on storytelling through experiential moments. And I am joined today with my amazing co-host, Pablo Henderson, who is CMO and strategist. Welcome, Pablo.
Dahlia, thank you so much. I usually try to remember our guests' intros by heart and then just like recite a few titles. But these two guests had such long intros that I had to write them down and read them. So I'm actually super excited to welcome Bridget and Joe to the podcast. As I said, I'm going to read because they're quite extensive, but I think worthwhile. And after all, we are going to be speaking about, you know, and two experiential billionaires. So I would expect nothing less than very long bios. With more than 30 years experience as an entrepreneur, founder, and owner, Joe Hoff has helped tens of thousands of people around the world, built several eight-figure businesses, and has had multiple successful exits. Now as a keynote speaker, co-author of the upcoming book, Experiential Billionaire, not so upcoming because it's out live on bookshelves, so go get it, Build a Life Rich in Experiences and Die with No Regrets, he and his business partner, co-author Bridget Hilton, have spent years interviewing social science experts, conducting the largest study on experiences ever done, and turning themselves into experiential guinea pigs. Bridget, who I have known for quite some time now and had the pleasure of doing business with and brainstorming with, grew up in Flint, Michigan. As a teenager, she used her love of music as fuel for a different future and hustled her way into the largest record label in the world, helping to launch some of today's biggest careers in music, such as Rihanna, The Weeknd, Lady Gaga, and Taylor Swift. Inspired by a viral video of a deaf woman hearing for the first time, she then founded and bootstrapped the first ever social good electronics company, Listen, sold millions of products, partnered with the likes of Google, Delta Airlines, and Amazon, and has given over 50,000 people the gift of hearing for the first time. Now, if that's not an intro, there is one intro that I recommend everybody go listen to, and it's the guy who's the hot dog eating world champion. He has the most epic intro I've ever heard. It went viral. And maybe I'll include that in a link at some stage. If ever you want to tee up your intros, he is his personal MC and makes this massive announcement before he goes into any competition. And I think that you deserve that. If you're the world hot dog eating champion, you deserve that type of intro. But Joe and Bridget come pretty close. So welcome to our podcast.
By the way, just to jump in really quickly, if that's not a testament to how much we love experiences, I don't know what
it is. That's next on my list. Hot dog eating.
Yeah. I'm just going to throw out there, we can't say the world champion hot dog eater and not say his name. It's Joey Chestnut.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, if you haven't seen him, it's a spectacle to behold. Yeah.
Okay.
Awesome. Thanks for having us, guys.
Thanks for being here. So I think we have to acknowledge that both of you have done a lot of traveling, especially recently. And I'm curious, we kind of dipped into it a little bit right before this conversation, but I'm curious, when we talk about travel, you need to figure out a way to prep. Then you also need to like survive the actual travel part and then even like recovery from it. What does that look like on your end?
Well, we've done quite a bit. I mean, Joe just experienced it like last week, so...
But I would assume there's like a prepping for it, right?
Yeah, I think that, that's probably the thing that people underestimate the most. You know, we all like think, you know, oh, I'm going to travel the world. I want to see all these things and do all these, trips and experiences. And we severely underestimate like the physical toll, the planning time, et cetera. That's why it's really important to start taking small steps, start figuring things out, start collaborating, doing research, asking people for, you know, tips, et cetera. But yeah, I think like the planning is as big a step as the trip usually, because without the right like preparation, the trip is a lot a lot harder. And that can be anything. That can be from just like planning the wrong connections or the wrong, you know, departure times, the wrong arrival airport, the wrong not understanding the distances to the hotels, or, you know, there's all these things that play into like how tired you're going to be or how ready you're going to be. So once you get that stuff down a little bit, though, I think that it makes everything a lot easier. But the other rule with anyone that travels a lot, and I'm sure you guys will agree to this, is you have to be ready to change things on the fly, because things happen all the time. You know, your best laid plans will be out the window. You know, I was just traveling my family. We went to the UK, and then we took our kids up to Finland to Santa's village, which is like a bucket list trip for us, you know, obviously getting to meet Santa in the North Pole, which is really awesome. But on top of that, you know, the travel's a bit hard. It's a connecting flight through Finland, through Helsinki. And on the way back, the flight was delayed. The first flight, we missed the connection. There's another flight. A bag fell out of the overhead and hit my son in the head.
Oh my God.
Oh yeah. This was like a spiral event. But again, you just have to keep, you know, okay, how do we get to the next place and get there? And then, you know, just, I guess my advice to anybody that's in the middle of a really long travel day or trip, that the hard parts, just think this too shall pass.
Yes. 100% agree with that.
You just have to remember.
A really simple thing that I do is just to go outside once you get to the place that you're going to, is like to get, if it's during the day, get sunshine. Like that really helps. Like I always do that on long trips to like Europe or Africa or whatever. It's like go outside right away and like just acclimate yourself to like the sun. And like it really, really helps.
Yeah. Morning and evening.
Yeah.
Joe, is your son okay? I'm like,
that's a longer story. He actually wound up having a concussion. He's like two. And
Oh my God.
Yeah, and actually he's better. He's okay now. He's, you know, he's still, I believe, technically has the, you know, concussion for however long they say before it completely heals. But yeah, it was very scary, very unfortunate event. But again, like those are the things you can't predict. You know, you don't really, you just have to be ready to adapt if something happens. And
yeah. And that kind of thing can happen anywhere, you know, it doesn't have to be traveling. So you just never know.
Yeah.
Which is another point, you know, be ready to like know who to call and where to go if something goes wrong. It's also a pretty important thing to know. So,
yeah. Are you planning on putting him in sports? Because this might be the beginning of your future.
You know.
Oh, the other one already plays soccer and he's like, you know, just turned four.
Yeah.
I would prefer if they don't have any head contact sports. That's for sure. Yeah.
We all wish for that. Unfortunately, it doesn't work out. Yeah,
exactly. We're just along for the ride. It's their life, right?
Yeah. So what I'm hearing from you is you need a combination of being type A and willing to be flexible on the go, right?
Yeah. It's really the truth. It's the truth. And just, I think, you know, expectations, right? I think the way to have a really amazing trip is to plan it all as best as you can and then lower the expectations to just be like, whatever happens is going to be what's supposed to happen and it's going to be fine. But if you have like a vision of like it being a perfect day, it's never going to be that perfect day. But then when it is pretty close, it's just that much more special where you're like, wow, that was amazing. Like Bridget and I remember like standing on top of like at Machu Picchu and just being like, the weather was perfect. The day was perfect. Everything was just absolutely perfect. It was like a week of scuffle to kind of get there, but you forget all that, you know, and then all of a sudden it's just like, it was worth it. All the stuff was absolutely worth it.
That's funny. That's like actually one of my biggest tips for travel is that you're going to forget all of those like little bad things that happened. Like I had a huge trip this year. I went to India and Egypt, and that is a long ways away, right? Like that's a long trip, but I forgot all of the bad things that happened. There was flight delays and there was like all this stuff that happened, but I don't ever think about that. I only like see the pictures that I'm like, oh, that was such a great moment and like such a huge, like life-changing trip that I don't ever think about the bad thing. So just like keep that in mind that you're not going to remember that in like, you know, even like 6 months or like a year.
So we're talking about travel, which always feels like a default experience for like wish lists. Like, and I'm sure that your research probably uncovered that as a main topic. But I was talking to my wife about this upcoming episode and telling her about how fascinating I found the topic. And she and I went on to a bit of a tangent around spontaneity versus planning, and that spontaneity is a luxury. And so if you want to be an experiential billionaire, you need to be an amazing planner and plan that type of a life. And so I feel like it kind of builds off the same idea of how to build a perfect trip. You need to hold on to the details and then let go of it all and see how some of it pans out and be really flexible in your expectations. Is that something that you, from the research that you did on the book, that you found that people needed to plan to live these very intentional lives, or were they rich lives that fell into place through a mindset, like a growth mindset, for example?
I think it's both. I think you have to have a growth mindset. And we talk a lot about that in the book, but it's also that planning. Like when we asked 20,000 people, like why they didn't do the things they wanted to do, like the number one reason was that they just didn't get around to it. Right. So that's planning. Like if you just plan the things that you want, and a lot of the book is about how to plan, why to plan, like what you're going to do with those plans, who's going to hold you accountable to those plans. So I would say the number one thing is planning, but also having that growth mindset where you're like, you know what, I can try this. Like maybe I didn't know how to, like, you know, cook paella, but there's a paella class in Spain and I'm here. So why don't I do that? You know, just like little things that you're like, okay, maybe I can do that versus like, oh, I don't want to do that because I'm afraid.
Yeah, it's identity, right? Like once you've, if you've told yourself long enough that, oh, I don't travel or I don't like to do X or I'm not that type of person, fill in the blank. Then when those things come up, the default answer is, oh no, I couldn't, or oh, no, I don't know. But by planning and putting yourself in like different foreign situations, whether it's travel or just a new idea or business or whatever it is, you're building that muscle in your brain that says, if something new comes my way, I'm going to check it out and I'm going to see if it's something I want to try. And, you know, you get better at that, better at those new and novel experiences. And really that's the thing that, you know, from the studies and the science that makes people remember and feel that those moments kind of expanded time. It's because they're new and novel, which is why travel is always so high on people's list, because it's always new and novel if you travel to a new place. But to your point, the plan gets you into a position where everything's new and novel. And then you have to relax enough that if something special comes up or different comes up, you're open to trying that too. You might disregard like whatever part of the plan for a different plan. So,
yeah. Isn't the irony that you probably didn't, when you set out in the, and we'll get to the beginning of your own stories, but you probably didn't set out in the early stages of your life to ever think you would be authors of a book about being experiential Never. Billionaires, right? Yeah, writing a book requires a lot of planning. So maybe that's a good segue to how you got to where you even are, because I mentioned in the bios, you know, really interesting backgrounds. But it was somewhat circuitous, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. I think this is a perfect example of the importance of action and taking steps, because your perspective changes. So you don't know what the opportunities are a step ahead until you take a step. So that's why, you know, you don't know how many paths are going to open up or close or whatever the case until you move. And, you know, people are stuck, you know, people forget that because they're like stuck in, maybe it's a feeling of safety or just comfort or fear. But yeah, I think it might be, we can just go through the backstory or maybe that'll give a better idea of like how we got here. And we'll do the quick version, the LinkedIn live version.
We won't do the 50-minute keynote version.
Yeah. So when I was born, no. when I was a kid, like high school, I barely graduated high school. I had a pretty, you know, wild and somewhat self-destructive adolescence that I managed to rein in enough to graduate high school. But, you know, my prospects were limited. I didn't have the potential path to success of like college. And I don't know what would have happened realistically to my life. But what happened is right around my 18th birthday, my dad had a very sudden health episode, basically a near-death experience that lasted for a couple of months. He wound up getting a heart transplant and surviving. But this moment in my life was super impactful because my dad was only 48 years old. So I literally saw, you know, someone very close to me that almost lost out on all of these things they wanted to do in their life because they put them off to some future that basically almost didn't exist. And that gave me this great gift of urgency at a really critical moment in my life where I don't know what would have happened otherwise. But because of that, I started trying to figure out when I watched my dad had to change his entire life, by the way. He got this transplant and literally had to change his entire life. He wound up moving to a beach town in Mexico. He was on disability, super limited income. And he wound up having this incredible life doing all these things that he had always wanted to do, but had just put off before. So watching that kind of unfold inspired me to figure out what I wanted to do with my life and how to do it. I'm trying to figure out how to do it. And I just kind of started off on this path of like, you know, I was afraid. I had all the same, you know, excuses that we all have for not doing things or moving forward. I mean, I didn't have any connections or any money and didn't know where to start. And obviously, I was afraid, you know, that's the big thing. You know, I was really, what if I try things and fail? But watching my dad go through that experience made me realize like what I should be afraid of is what if I never try, you know, like what if I never have another chance or any of those things. So I wound up literally changing my life, you know, minus the near-death experience at a young age. I wound up moving away from everyone I grew up with. I moved to the beach. I basically started trying to fill my life. I started trying to think of the things that I would regret not doing if I suddenly found myself in a situation like my dad where I was out of time and trying to do those things. And these weren't like crazy bucket list things. This wasn't like climb Mount Everest or anything. I was young. I was just trying to do things that mattered to me. And I was honestly like pretty broke financially most of the time. I was like working like multiple jobs. I didn't really see a path to like a successful future in like that world. But, you know, again, looking at what happened with my dad, I thought, well, the important thing in life is to do the things you want to do. So I was just focused on trying to have a lot of experiences. But the more experiences I had, I kept meeting more and more people and building these bonds and creating these relationships that were really deep and meaningful. And literally that led to one day a friend calling and asking me if I wanted to start a company with them. Again, up until then, I'd been like waiting tables and bartending at night. And so I told my friend, I was like, I don't really have any experience starting a business. And they told me, you'll figure it out. And that was like a really crazy moment because I realized that, you know, it wasn't my business experience that mattered to them. They just saw that I knew how to figure out how to get new and interesting things accomplished. And that was something they thought would be, you know, helpful in business. So we started this t-shirt company out of a garage and it didn't work. The t-shirt company, but as a testament to my friend's like logic about why we should partner. Again, by the way, this was the grandiose business idea. It was like, you know, a t-shirt company and a garage. But in my world, it was like we were Dolce & Gabbana, but it was a fun time. And we wound up growing and morphing this t-shirt company into a warehousing and shipping company for other apparel companies, other apparel brands. And we built it into a 100-person plus business over the next, you know, set amount of time. And that was like a really impactful period as well, because what happened was at the end of, right around the time we got to like 100 employees, I realized 10 years had gone by. And I had stopped doing all the things I cared about. I had stopped looking for those things. I had stopped finding the things that mattered to me. And right around that time, my life digressed into a country western song because my wife and I got divorced. My dog died. My dad, after his amazing 10 plus bonus years, actually passed. And when it was crazy because when I went to his funeral, I just remember all those feelings and that moment from before when, you know, he was going through the near-death experience. And it inspired me to relook at my life and figure out what I cared about and figure out what I wanted to do. And I realized I wanted to do something that helped people. And as cliche as that sounds, I thought, well, you know, that's something I want to do. Why don't I do it now? And my dad had started, this is like a part of the inspiration, I'm sure, but my dad had started a charity in Mexico with, he was literally making $716 a month. And he started a charity with a friend with $100 a month that they were helping a family that lived in a landfill, give their kids like school books and education. That grew and spiraled. By the time he passed a decade later, they had already put hundreds of kids all the way through university. This was from one act, you know, so I saw like, wow, if he could do that, like, what could I do? So I left the company that I'd started with my friend and started another company that worked with charities. And again, all these things, you know, became possible just from like moving forward, taking steps, taking action. And that moment, you know, of kind of chasing my dreams and putting my someday ideas into action changed my life. You know, I wound up getting to travel the world, and I got to help provide clean water to communities in Haiti. I got to build schools in Guatemala. I got to help do things like rehabilitate victims of trafficking in Indonesia and Southeast Asia. It wasn't, again, like, you know, it wasn't like a huge financial success, but it was a huge life success. I was like living this very, very powerful moment. And I didn't know where that was going to go. I just knew that I felt like I was really living my ideal self for the first time ever. And because of those trips and what I was doing, that's how I met my wife now, Yasmin. And because of like me changing what I was doing and working with charity, that's how Bridget and I connected. And that just kicked off a whole nother level of life that I'll let Bridget tell.
Sure. So I'll go a little bit into my backstory. So I grew up in Flint, Michigan, a place that's famous for like Michael Moore movies and like the water crisis and not very positive things. But when I was a kid, I really like from a very young age wanted to be like famous for like something else. Like I was obsessed with music. That was like my entire life. I had like, you know, the posters all around my room. Like I would, you know, every Christmas gift, whatever, had to be like the newest CD from whatever artist that came out. Like I was just fully, fully obsessed. Like, and my favorite TV show at the time was The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. So I was like really into someday moving to California. Like that was my dream from when I was like a little kid. So there was like a few problems, obviously. Like, you know, I didn't know anyone that was like in music or in movies or anything like that. You know, growing up where I grew up, my entire family works for General Motors. I was the only person that had no interest in working in the auto industry. And like, you know, good for them, but that just wasn't my thing. So when I was a kid and I would tell people like, oh, I want to be in music, like everyone was kind of just like, okay, that's like very unrealistic because there was no one that we knew that did any of that stuff. But I was very determined and I started at age 14, like working in like music venues and like doing things like cleaning up trash. Like, you know, I skipped my high school prom to like clean up trash at like the Elton John concert, literally. I was like that obsessed with it. And I was doing all these like little jobs, like writing reviews and like the local paper and, you know, getting coffee at radio stations and stuff like that, basically for free or for like $5 an hour. So eventually after like 5 years of that, my efforts paid off and I never became like a rock star like I wanted, but I got a job in the mailroom at the local Universal Music Group office, which they no longer have there. But at the time they had like kind of satellite offices all around the country. So even though I was like at the time living like on my friends' couches and on their floors, like I felt like, you know, a billionaire because I was making like 20 grand a year suddenly versus $0 a year. So that was like a huge moment in my life. And, you know, that job started with like licking stamps and mailing boxes and all those typical like Hollywood stories that you hear. But I ended up moving to Los Angeles when I was 21 and my dream started coming true. And it was kind of like the first time that I could realize like, oh my God, if I just take these small steps, like I can actually like make my dreams come true. And I had a lot of good times like during those years. And like, you know, my tasks for my job was like, you know, driving Taylor Swift around to like radio stations when she was like, you know, 15 or whatever. This one time I had like, I was like the security for Sting at like this bookstore autograph signing that he was doing. And like, I remember taking like Rihanna to eat like chicken tenders at TGI Fridays. And like, just like working with these artists when they're like, you know, beginning, it's like, it was such a fun job. But, you know, after, you know, years of that, I still like wasn't making any money. And I was like, during the day, I was like working in cubicles. And then at night I was going out and it was like kind of a very exhausting job, but very fun. And, you know, like one day at my office, I was sitting watching YouTube as you do. And, I saw a video of a 29-year-old woman named Sloan hearing for the first time, thanks to like a special kind of hearing aid. And, it just like hit me. It was like one of those light bulb moments that you see in movies or whatever, where it was like, oh, that's what I want to do. Like, I want to help people hear, because to me, like, music had been like the biggest gift in my life and like had changed my whole life and whole trajectory. Like, I don't know where I would be if I didn't have that passion for music. So when I saw the video, I just thought of like what my life would have been like without that. So basically I had like sent this video to Joe, and I was like, he was the only person that I knew that had been any sort of involved in charity. So I sent it to him and I was like, we should start a company that gives people hearing. I didn't really know how to do that. Like, I had zero experience starting a company, but I knew that the end result was that, like, hopefully we could travel the world and help people, which was like, you know, probably the best job of all time. But long story short, we, like, you know, 2 weeks later after I sent the video, we jumped on a plane to China without like any idea on how the electronics industry worked. And we bought like very limited inventory. I cashed out my 401k from Universal, which was like $5,000, you know, we didn't have like a lot of money to start this company, but we like were hand making our own packaging. And like, you know, we made our own websites. We made everything. Like, we were shipping the stuff out of my kitchen. Like, my kitchen was like just completely full of like, you know, packaging that we got from Michael's craft store. But yeah, we, you know, eventually like it started to work. And like a year later, we were in Peru and we had sold enough headphones and speakers to fund this mission. And we were like, it was just the most, probably like one of the most memorable things in my entire life is like the first time we sat down with this girl. She was like our first patient. Her name was Maria, and it was like her birthday, and her parents had like, you know, told us that it was like her biggest dream in life to hear, because she felt like she couldn't fit in her community. And like, you know, she wasn't going to the school that she wanted to and whatever. And so we sat down with this girl, and it was just this moment of like, this was just a dream like a year ago, right? Like a year ago, we were sitting like, oh, I wish I could do this. But we had like worked for that whole year to this moment where like it was a reality. And this girl like heard for the first time because of like this small step that we had taken like a year ago. So it was just the most incredible moment to like see somebody here for the first time and like feel like her dream come true, but also like our dream come true. So ever since then, we've given like over 50,000 people the gift of hearing for the first time and kind of all over the world. You know, it's like we've done stuff in the US as well, but a lot of stuff like in Kenya, Rwanda, Mexico, China, like all over. And it's funny, like the whole time, like everyone was like, we had this moment where I was in Forbes 30 under 30 and Inc. 30 under 30. And all of these people were like coming to me, like people that I had like gone to high school with, for example. And they'd be like, oh my God, you're killing it. Like, can you, you know, can I borrow some money? And I would always just like laugh. And I'm like, we're giving away all of our money, like to travel and help people around the world. But so I'm like, not a billionaire. I don't even know how I ended up on this Forbes list, but I do feel like an experiential billionaire, because we were doing all these things around the world. And like, you know, it was just the most incredible time. So that's kind of how the experiential billionaire name like came to be, is because we never like made a ton of money, but we always were like living these really crazy, fulfilling lives and like following our dreams. And so, you know, we had all these crazy things. Like, we went to the pyramids, we went gorilla trekking in Rwanda, we went to Iceland and with the Northern Lights and like saw the Taj Mahal, and, you know, went to Tanzania. Like, there's just so many cool moments where I was like, I don't think I could ever experience these things if I was just like working a normal job. Right. So it wasn't just, sorry, go on.
You said this, like, a couple of times, and I read it on your site, and like Pablo's mentioned it, 50,000, you've given 50,000 people the opportunity to be able to hear. And like, every time I hear it, it doesn't hit home as much as like the time that you just said it. It really resonates that like you made a difference. And it's funny because as you were saying, as you were going through your entire experience, FIT had reached out to me previously to schedule some classes. And they suggested January 2nd as a class. And I was like, do we really think people are going to take classes on January 2nd? I adjusted my entire travel schedule based on this single class. I fully expected it to be canceled. It wasn't. It was packed. And it really resonated with me that people they really value January 1st as a pivotal point to say, what does my year look like? How can things change? The problem is they don't always know how to create that change. And I find that like when they get into my class, they're soul searching. They're trying to figure out how to make it happen. And I'm synthesizing your stories and your passions, but really you took a chance on each other. And I think that that's hard for people to do. I think it's hard for them to embrace change, for them to even be able to envision something different. It feels scary. And I would be curious about your journey together. I mean, seems like you guys still like each other. That's a big deal.
It's funny.
Talia, I'm going to take that personally because you're implying that after collaborating on a project for a number of years, they might not like each other. A clue here.
Yeah, you should see.
Some people don't like. I've never had a romantic relationship that's lasted this long. You know.
yeah. You guys still like each other. I think it's a big deal. This is a real, like, tangible relationship. And by the way, a lot of people can't say that. They can't say that they've had partners that have lasted this long.
I mean, I think the testament is to. I mean, Joe's an amazing person, and like we have so much in common. We came from a very similar, like, blue collar background, and that really helps, you know, like having those like morals and those like, you know, vision for the future and that hustle. But also it's a testament to the experiences that we've had. Like we've had the craziest experiences together that I've never had with anyone else, right? So like we've bonded through those experiences, through those long travel days, through like giving people, you know, hearing or building schools or whatever, like, you know, it might be like those experiences together, like help us bond and like, you know, and we both have similar, you know, things that we do. Like we can laugh at anything. And I think that's really important is like to not take it too seriously because things have like blown up in our face a million times. And it's just been a roller coaster for the last, like, what, 12 years that we've known each other, but we can both just be like, okay, we can get through this. Like no matter what.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's funny. Somebody asked us recently before a podcast if there were any like really low moments that we had that we could talk about. You're like, it's mostly low moments. Like, when I think of like, our story, did you not? If you read the book, it's like it's a lot of lows and a couple of, you know. But I think that what's interesting is there's a couple things about that really jump out, and these are really core. Tenets. These are like pillars of, you know, how to like live an experiential life and be, you know, happy and fulfilled. And the one is, you know, the fear part, right? We have all these fears of trying things and taking action and doing things and, you know, having, you know, working with someone, whatever it is, because we grossly overestimate what could go wrong and underestimate what could go right. So when you really stop and think about what, you know, what's the best thing that could happen, and then you think about what's the worst thing that could happen, almost always the best thing is like, you know, this crazy, wild grand slam, probably even more than you can think of. And the worst thing is like we tried it and it didn't work and it failed and we lost, you know, some time, but we got some knowledge. The second thing that I think is really important is when you work with somebody, the thing that Bridget and I have, I think, together is we believe in each other. And that's like 100%, obviously, besides the fact that we actually like each other, we actually believe in each other and we trust each other. And I think that to really try to become a better version of yourself, it's so helpful to have somebody that believes in you and that holds you accountable. So like we hold each other accountable. Like she believes in me, but she'll also be like, hey, we need to do this thing. We need to get X done. And, you know, you said we were going to do this and vice versa. You know, like I'll keep her in check. She keeps me in check. And I think that makes people grow. You know, I think that having an accountability partner, if I say, hey, we're going to, you know, the book's got to be done by X day, you know, then, you know, she's, you know, calling me all last year, like, hey, the book's got to be done by X day. Pick the publishers, et cetera. So yeah, I think that, you know, having a teammate or a partner is really, really, really helpful. Having an accountability partner for whatever your dreams or goals are. Once you say something out loud to someone that can be, you know, it can bring you a lot closer. And to Bridget's point, once you start having those experiences, we all know that, right? If you go on like a you know, a camping trip or to some destination wedding or go do something that you have never done before and meet somebody and spend 48 hours with them doing something new and fun and cool. That's your friend forever. You know, that's a good friend now. You're going to check in with all the time. So that's
yeah, it's like if you have like a coffee meeting with someone mm-hmm. versus like you go surfing with someone is like a good example. It's like you're going to like be closer with the person that you went surfing with versus like having a coffee. So you've had a coffee with someone a million times in your life. Like you probably don't remember 1% of your coffee meetings, right? But you remember that time you went like on a hike or a surf or paddleboard with someone for a meeting, you know?
Yeah.
So you go, the next chapter in your story is that you end up writing this book, which synthesizes the research that you've done, speaking to all these people, and takes a lot from your personal lives and the epiphanies that you've had around the value of growth and being active and experiencing a diverse number of different aspects of life. And as you said, the good and the bad. One of the things that I thought about from the book at a, like an existential level is imagine I'm a farmer in the middle of a field in Idaho. And every day I plow my fields and I have an amazing family and I'm one with nature. And I contemplate my existence, but I don't necessarily travel to India. I've never seen the pyramids. I have my community and I have meaningful relationships around me. Can I still be an experiential billionaire?
100%. I
mean, first of all, I think that sounds like an awesome life and yeah, I kind of want to go do that. But I mean, for me, the quick answer is like, of course, like those things that we've done, like those are what we wanted to do, right? And everybody wants different things. We're never saying like, you have to see the pyramids because that would be crazy, right? But this guy, you know, in your story, maybe he's never gone fly fishing, right? So like, that's his goal in life is to like become an amazing fly fisher. Like, so he starts doing that versus saying, I'm going to do that someday. And I think that that's the point. So whatever it is you want to do, like, I'm sure this guy is like, no one's like 100% done everything they always want to do, right? So maybe it's fly fishing. Maybe it's like, I want to start watching the sunset with my wife every night or something like that, you know, and then they start.
Maybe they want to teach. Maybe they want to teach their kids to farm. Maybe they want to teach their kids a musical instrument. Maybe they want their kids to read the Bible front to back, or they want to read the Bible front to back. Whatever it is, somebody's got a someday that they're putting off because of something that's keeping them busy that would mean a lot if they did it. Yeah. So it's definitely a choose your own adventure.
Well, so there's a second part to my guy, because he could just also be a Buddhist monk on a mountain, right? And so I started thinking, is a counter approach to becoming an experiential billionaire the idea of having less regret and more gratitude? And that if you were to eliminate regret and lean into gratitude, you in fact would never need to leave any place or do anything. You would have lived the perfect life. And I know that's a utopian concept. It's kind of like, wow, what a crazy ideal. And you still need the growth part of that. But I'm trying to be a bit of a devil's advocate against this idea that we need to become experiential junkies. Because I think that there's another side of that that could potentially imply that we need to consume, right? It's not physical. We're not buying more. We're not eating more, but we are still consuming more by becoming experiential billionaires. And I worry that in Western culture, this consumption mentality that we need to be, it's like becoming an adrenaline junkie, right? You're still a junkie. Yeah. It's just a different type of junkie. Like I see David Goggins or other people, like you're just hooked on a different thing, you know? I shouldn't pick on David Goggins. I have a bad habit of like bringing up specific names on the podcast, and that's not cool. But you know, he's one that I know a lot of people can relate to. And
to riff on that, we'll throw Pablo right under the bus. He is for sure an adrenaline junkie. So,
So I should also footnote that with I shouldn't be a hypocrite because I'm probably speaking about myself. You know, like there is a trap in all of that too, right?
That's a great clarification.
Sorry, go on, Joe.
Oh, I was going to say that I think that, you know, it's important to help clarify like the definition of experiential billionaire. It doesn't mean that you're stacking up, you know, as many experiences as you can, it means that you're making your life experience rich and rewarding. So that's what your life needs. So your life could be like, again, like maybe my life is my, maybe my experience is I want to write, you know, a series of books and that's all I do. That's it. But that's what I want to do. Then that is what's going to make me feel like I have a rich and rewarding life. I did the thing I wanted to do, et cetera. It doesn't have to cost any money. It doesn't have to be consuming anything. It doesn't have to require travel. And to your point, yeah, travel came up a ton in the survey. But again, I think it's because people subconsciously associate that with, you know, something that's meaningful because it's new and novel. And that, you know, expands your perception of time in your life. But that doesn't mean that it has to be any of those things. It's really not about that. And it's almost, I would argue, like, you know, I understand the point of like, you know, consumption or anti-consumption, right? I think that we're probably far more minimalist than anything. And we're not like seeking, you know, always like, you know, it's just because something is a new experience that, you know, would be something really cool adrenaline wise. That doesn't mean we're going to jump at it if it doesn't fit in our lives. But people will. There's some people that are going to become that, you know, I just need to do as many things and they'll probably build like a 3 trillion person following and become like famous for that. But that's definitely not the goal. The goal is
And I think like, you know, the monk thing is like, is such a small percentage of the population and I get what you're saying, but like the reality is like when we asked, you know, 20,000 people, like what their biggest regret was, it was like, 80% of them said not doing something, right? So they're all saying that it's like because they didn't do something. So we're trying to like help people do those things that they wanted to do versus like them saying, oh, I feel totally satisfied.
Like, let's actually add a little color to that, Bridget. You know what most of the things were, Pablo? They were things like, I regret not calling my parents more. I regret not keeping in touch with old friends. I regret not taking my kids camping. They weren't huge adrenaline things. They weren't climb Mount Everest. They weren't staying over water bungalows. They were normal things that we put off. Like that was the vast majority of things. So I think that it's a lot more of just people realizing, wow, you know, I said I was going to take my family on like a camping road trip one summer and the kids are almost out of school. I never did it. What happened? You know, so
I'm aggressively nodding to everything you're saying right now, because I really relate to what you're saying. And I think that's a great perspective on how to make sure that you have filled the gaps in your life with the things that matter. And what's funny is that we live in a world where there, you know, we fill the gaps with scrolling right now and other things. And those same gaps could be filled with a phone call or could be filled with, you know, same amount of time. You know, I had a funny experience yesterday. I've actually been applying some of the teachings from the book. I went to go visit somebody who's 85 yesterday in Manhattan because I'm out of work at the moment. And I said, well, you know, I got to do some things that I might not ever get the chance to do because I got some free time at the moment. I'm going to go visit my friend. So I go visit my old friend in New York up on the Upper West Side. But I'm so embarrassed to say that when I got to his place and he buzzed me in, I stood in front of the elevator for 10 minutes because I'd been scrolling and I didn't realize that the elevator had come and was like right there in front of me. And I was just like in a doom scroll. I just, you know, because what do you do while you're waiting for the elevator to come from the top of a New York building? You just pull out your phone and you look at something mindless instead of just having the patience to wait for the elevator. Well, that didn't last 15 seconds. It lasted like a long time. And I end up realizing those are the gaps. That's the mortar that sticks all these bricks together. That's your life, right? And so I love this idea that the regrets were not necessarily all about epic trips that weren't taken. They were about friendships that were not fostered and other things like that, because you can't really put a price on any of those things anyway.
Yeah, I love the story that you shared with me previously about how you asked your mom what she had always wanted to do. And she said, fly a plane. And then you were looking up that you guys could go. I just love that so much. And I feel like everyone should do that. It takes 10 seconds to ask somebody that you love, like, what did you always want to do? And then try to put that in motion. You know, that's going to mean more than any, like, you know, present or whatever.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because as we're like deep diving into these relationships, I think that that's the core of these experiential moments, right? Being able to experience it with people. And it keeps circling me back to your relationship together. Like, how have you stayed accountability partners? How have you motivated this, like, this really amazing relationship that has truly blossomed?
Probably partially out of necessity, you know, where we share multiple businesses and it's, we got to keep each other going because we got to pay the bills, but also because it's just like, we have so much love for each other that I want, you know, I always say, like, so we do speaking, keynote speaking, we do it together, but we also do it separately. And sometimes people will be like, aren't you like competing? And I'm like, no, like whatever Joe wins, like I win too. And whatever my wins are, like he wins as well. It's definitely never competing. So we're always like rooting for each other in success in business and in life.
Yeah, we you know, I think that, again, we constantly help each other grow as people. And that's, you know, that's, I think, that's a great relationship, any kind of relationship. And I think, you know, one of the things we talk about in the book is, you know, again, like the whole concept that we're talking about overall, by the way, is pretty obvious. It's that your time on this planet is the most valuable thing that you have, right? So the experiences you have, obviously, and the people that you spend it with. So you have to be very, very aware of like people that are toxic, people that make you not your best self, and people that are really positive influences and inspiring that make you a better person. So Bridget and I just, I think, bring each other up. And that's like the kind of person that you want to spend, obviously, time around. And I think, you know, there's something interesting you said about, you know, the experiences we have together are really important, but also the experiences that we have alone are really important because that's part of our relationship with ourselves. Like when you do something without anybody's help or that you said you were going to do and you just get through it or you just experience it alone, whether it's like going on a sunrise hike or, you know, whatever that thing is, like if you do that thing, that not only is so rewarding to you and your self-confidence and your belief that you can figure out how to do things that are hard and that matter and that make your life seem rewarding and fulfilled, it also is inspiring to other people. It gives other people permission, like, wow, I could do something that I wanted to do that's scary by myself. So I think that there's a value, obviously, in both of those things, because they're still, though, to your point, Dahlia, they're connected. Like when you do something alone, it's not really in a void, right? Because if you tell somebody that, you know, hey, I climbed Mount Whitney, the first thing you're going to hear if you tell people at a dinner party is somebody's going to go, oh my God, I want to climb Mount Whitney. How'd you do that? Like, you know, and then you're maybe kicked off somebody else going and climbing Mount Whitney, and that might kick off 10 more other people. And it's like, there's this chain reaction of things that happen when we do stuff that's like different and hard. So I think it's just a, you know, Bridget and I are good at pushing ourselves to do different hard things. I'll tell you one thing. Once we started writing the book and we figured out that we, you know, had this, what we feel is this valuable thing we could share with the world, the book took on a whole different life of its own, and it was really, really hard. And there were some very personal things that went on in both of our lives throughout that process. But I can honestly say that I don't think I wouldn't have gotten it done without her, like without her as my partner, and, you know, having that person to like do it together, it wouldn't have been possible for this particular thing. So sometimes you need somebody to help.
I mean, the beginning of the whole process, like I was going through like the hardest period of my life. Like it was in 2020, and like we had all these things happening with like COVID, and then I got like separated and I had to move, my place got broken into. Like there was just like a domino effect of like we had to like lay off employees that have been there since the beginning of Listen, and like our charity partners stopped working like temporarily. So we didn't have that like give back thing. Like there was just so many things that happened, and I was like in a really bad place, and like Joe was there for me. And then, you know, as I was like getting out of that, we were like writing the book, and then, you know, this huge, horrible thing happened to Joe. And then I was trying to like be there for him, and he can tell you more about that. But it's just always helpful to have like people there for you. Like your relationships are so important.
Yeah, I think that's like really the exclamation point on the message in the book. You know, we're trying to teach people to have, you know, to live life with the urgency of like having had a near-death experience minus the near-death experience. And, you know, we had finished the first draft of the book and we really believed this and the value and this way of life and saw what it could do to our lives. And, you know, right as Bridget was, you know, coming out of the other side of her mental health crisis and we finished the first draft, my second son had just been born a few months prior. In the span of a week, my wife went from having, you know, what she thought was a blocked breast duct to getting an ultrasound, to getting a mammogram, to getting a biopsy, to on her 34th birthday, getting diagnosed with stage 3 breast cancer, metastatic, spread to her lymph nodes, and going into chemotherapy the next week. Yeah. And it was just like, this is exactly what, you know, we were writing about. You know, the irony of this all is just obviously, you know, it is extraordinary. And, you know, the experience to anyone listening or watching right now, you know, she did 5 months of chemotherapy, a double mastectomy, 5 weeks of radiation, and a full year of immunotherapy, but she beat it, you know. And when we got to the other side of that and I got that pathology back that said it's gone and the treatments worked, and we looked to our future of what we were going to do, you know, like with my dad, you know, he had to change his whole life because he had put off everything in his life. And, you know, you always hear the stories of the people that have that near-death experience and they have to get up and, you know, they want to climb a mountain or, you know, propose to that person or go ride a bull or whatever the heck the thing is. We didn't have to change anything because we had been doing everything we wanted to do. We were intentional. We had been planning. We had been very, very aware of our time and very, you know, very much had gone after our goals and faced our fears. And that was like such a crazy moment to be like, wow, you know, like if anybody needs any more proof that this works, you know, obviously it was a potentially, you know, horrific situation. It was extraordinarily difficult to go through. And my wife was an amazing, amazing human being that was just, you know, the strongest person I can imagine. And I know in the world right now, there's millions of people going through this right now. And, you know, when you get to the other side of it, it's something special to know that no matter what happens, we're not going to regret the 10 years before because we did all the things we said we wanted to do. So there wasn't this feeling of like, oh, my God, I can't believe we had put off XYZ and blah, blah, blah. And now we got to try to squeeze a bunch of stuff in. It wasn't like that. So yeah, that's like a really powerful like moment of like, you know, knowing that we used the time we had wisely, not knowing how much more time we have.
Thank you. Thank you both for sharing that. Time is short and the stakes are high.
Yeah. And it's a journey, right? So we have to make sure that we show the people around us. I think it goes back to the people. Like, as long as you're doing things and creating those memories with the people that you love, that to me really speaks to those experiential moments.
Yeah. And to the things versus experience kind of thing, there's nothing wrong with wanting to fly a plane or race a car or, you know, take a boat trip or whatnot. But the thing itself isn't the goal, right? It's like that relationship with that person is worth more than the Ferrari or the boat or the yacht or whatever you want to call it. Like that experience, that memory, nobody on their deathbed goes, you know, God, I just want to see my wallet one more time. You know, it's like I just really want to like sit in my Ferrari one more time. No, they're thinking about the people in their lives and what they did to make the world a better place, what their legacy is going to be. So I think that's really the key.
Was there a piece of research from the study as you were working on the book or an insight that came from your personal experiences, you know, through the book writing experience that didn't go in the book that you kind of kept to the side because it wasn't a fit for this one, but might be for something else?
You mean like, what's the next book?
No, I mean, maybe it wasn't a piece of research that fit for this, you know, for this narrative, but that you thought was interesting. Or yeah, is there another book that's going to come out? I mean, I'm sure you've probably inspired to write about a lot of things at this point, but the question was more so about the research that you did and any insights that came from that.
I'll throw out two topics and then I'll let Bridget like kind of expound a bit. But two things that really jumped out that I think we could dive much deeper into. One was that a full third of the respondents said that the most valuable experience in their life was a negative experience, something that happened, negative thing happened to them for whatever reason that made them who they are. And I thought, you know, that is really powerful. And then I think like there's just so much more work to do around the health part of everything, you know, how it's all connected, how our mental health, our physical health, and our just overall health in terms of how we view our life, you know, are really related and how we really need to work on those things together. But yeah, Bridget, what do you
agree with that? I think that we don't talk enough about the health stuff in the book, but we can also expound on that, you know, later on in our work. But with the negative stuff, it's funny. A lot of people have told me after I tell them the story of writing the book and how crazy it was and how many like roller coaster moments we had. Like, for example, like we turned in the book and our publisher shut down the same week and like went bankrupt. Like, and that's not in the book, obviously, right? So it's like we had to scramble to like basically start our own imprint, like which we had no idea how to do. You know, we don't know how to like set up a book on Amazon and do all these things. There's so much that goes into it that's not like that was behind the scenes that we didn't really talk about. And so when I tell people these stories, they're like, you need to write a book about the experience of writing the book.
I love the two of you guys because
I feel like we're in sync on this, Pablo. I feel like we're going to say that like they kind of like find ways to push through any struggle or any problem. They're like, we're going to solve this together. We're going to figure it out. We don't need to sit here and say, oh, the world is pointing us in a different direction. Let's just give up. Like,
Dahlia and I did work on numerous occasions to keep drilling down on the topic of motivation and what makes people motivated. And there's a lot of debate around consistency and this and that. One of the key components to all of this that we've come up with in our own less scientific but extensive research is this idea of grittiness. And you guys are gritty.
Yeah, probably too.
Now, I think that I'm too gritty. And in fact, my greatest experience in my life has been a negative one. And it came about from me being too gritty. So that's a double-edged sword. But I think that the right level of the optimal level of grittiness, once you get, you know, don't get too obsessive, can actually be the secret. And I think you've both cracked the code on that.
Thank you. Yeah. That's actually something I really want to do research on, is exactly what you're saying, is that like we want to do all these things in our life because we didn't come from money. We never came from all these things. So we're like motivated to do these big things. But then like, what's the cost of that? Like, what if, you know, your kid doesn't have that bad experience or whatever? And I think the chapter in our book about like turning negatives into positives, like dives into that, but it's not enough. Like I could read a whole book on just that. So.
You know, it's an area that I think we would actually be interested in collaborating with you on. So if you do start getting into that world, we are so fascinated with the desire and demand, not only for grittiness, but to like motivate through those situations. And I think there's something to be said about that.
Yeah, it's hard to say. You know, it's like we asked all these people, like, you know, what, you know, about their negative experiences. And you know, people would say like, oh, I was like a heroin addict and it was horrible. But then I became this person that helped like hundreds of people get out of that experience. And it's like, what is the cost of that to the one person versus whatever? And what they're motivated only because of that. They never would have done that had they not had that negative experience. So it's all very interesting to me. And I'd love to collaborate on something.
Yeah, I think to Pablo's comment, you know, I think that there is such an art to being gritty, but also realizing when you're being stubborn. And you know, like there's so many times we've been guilty of it, where there's something we need to let go. And we're trying still to just like get that square through the circle, you know, square block through the circle. And at some point you're like, we're doing more damage than good. Like you got to stop.
How do you know when to like stop? How to get back?
Yeah, I think, and to your comment, Dahlia, also, I think that is like the core message of like finding like a fulfilling life personally and professionally, is figuring things out, right? Because if the more you try to figure things out, the better you get at just figuring things out. And it doesn't mean that you're the smartest person in the room. It means that you have the confidence and you've built your brain, your muscle up to like know that when something happens, you're gonna figure out something. It's gonna, and the, you know, the older we get and the more we go through things, we always seem to, when you look back, you always get through it somehow. Something happens. You get to the end of it somehow. So that's why there's not like 12-year-old wise people, you know. It's always an old wise person, right? Because they've seen enough things to know that this is going to pass. We're going to figure it out. We're going to get to the other side. So right now we got to stop worrying and just figure it out.
Yeah. No, and I appreciate that. I think that's a good note to kind of end on. I think Pablo and I usually get a huge request for recommendations around podcasts, obviously books, et cetera. Do you have three resources that you would recommend to our audience? Ooh. I know, sorry, I'm putting you on the spot.
I'm like looking at my giant bookshelf right now. There's just so, I love to read. So there's so much. I think a book that I really liked that came out a couple of years ago was around getting out of your comfort zone, which is called The Comfort Crisis. I really loved that book. That was one of my favorites. Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, are you saying book recommendations and podcast recommendations in general?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think from the podcast, you know, obviously there's two things I'll say. I think podcast wise, you know, obviously different people have different styles. I love like science-based information. So things like Andrew Huberman, like the Huberman Lab, you know, obviously it's super popular. But I think that if you go down that rabbit hole, there's a lot of spin-off stuff that you can find that might be topical to your interests. And I also think that one of the least utilized things is on audio, audiobooks and Audible is the great courses. The great courses, you can literally listen to world-class, you know, best in their field professors at the top universities around the world give full 20, 30, 40 lecture courses. And, you know, within the course of maybe your normal workout for a few weeks, you can learn, you know, the equivalent of a college, you know, education in some topic. It's just really, really great. And then book wise, you know, I think we're all trying to do, you know, self-help, quote unquote. You know, there's a lot of things that we can get out of that, but I think everyone should try to find fiction that speaks to them. I think there's something magical about letting your brain be that third wall, like, you know, paint that picture in your mind, escape everything else. I think there's just something really powerful about that. And different people have different types of fiction.
Amen to that. I am a big believer that we've kind of over-indexed on the self-help piece. And I was watching something the other day that to tell you how powerful fiction is, when you think about what it took for people to learn to read and the sacrifices they made to read because they had no TV, they had no radio, they had nothing except for a book as entertainment. And so there was so much desire to learn and to grow that people went through fire to learn how to synchronize these 26 letters in the alphabet and then decode them. And it was primarily for fiction because that was the magic.
Wow. I'd never thought about that. I'm honestly really bad at fiction. I have like an entire bookshelf of like, there's might be three fiction books on there, like out of hundreds of books. But so I need to get better at that. But I will say like one thing for me, that's not a specific, you know, podcast, whatever, is that I spend a lot of time on YouTube just learning how to do new things. And the reason I love that so much is because A, it's free, but B, it's like, we live in this incredible era. You know, there's a lot of problems in the world, of course, but there's also like so much opportunity where it's like, you know, I can spend $0 and learn basically any skill that I want to learn. And like, that was not available to us, like, you know, 20, 30, 40 years ago. Yeah. And forever before that, right? So like we have the opportunity to learn whatever we want, which is so awesome. And like, yeah. So it doesn't have to be a specific thing, you know, say you want to learn how to like make dumplings for some, like, you know what I mean? It can be like the smallest thing, but you can go on YouTube right now and learn how to do that versus like, you know, back in the day, you would have to like know somebody that did that, or maybe there's a book about it.
I agree. I think that the barrier to entry to learn information and also be able to take it, internalize it, and then create our own experiences from it really is so low now that there's no excuse. I'm learning how to make bread.
Exactly. Like type it in the internet. Like it's so easy. It's like, yeah. I could learn, like I didn't go to college, right? But I could like go on like Harvard's website and take a free class at Harvard if I wanted to. Like, yeah. It's just like so incredibly like mind blowing, like where people just don't take advantage of it enough. So that would be my last.
Well, I'm heading off to look at a YouTube video on how to hula hoop because that's been on my bucket list for 2024. So that's what I'll be doing next. Yeah. In the meantime, thank you so much, Bridget. I mean, this was rich, really rich.
Joe said his internet just crashed, but he. Okay.
This was amazing. It was really nice to kind of like hear a different perspective, to also like find moments of happiness where we don't necessarily have to focus on only work, but it's also like the pleasures in life. And I think that that helps round us out as people. So it's like nice to hear it from that perspective. And I really do think that we should find some time to collaborate on the grittiness conversation. I feel like that's a conversation Pablo and I have often, and there's a lot of value there.
Yeah, I totally agree. Let's do it. I'm excited to talk more.
I love it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Being a part of this. Nice to see you.
You too. Bye.